The term that is used in the scriptures is panya chaku, or the eye of wisdom. The eye of wisdom. Or you can, the comparable terms are that of vijja, awareness. And so that it's that awake knowing quality of mind. A way of clarifying that is just to use that question, who is it that's aware? And when you can leave it as it is, Kathy, so I prefer the dim, thank you. So because when you ask that question in the quietness of the mind, the word who becomes very, very peculiar. Right. Huh? It's not just an idea that it's a doesn't apply, but there's a direct sense of, oh, this isn't really a who, it's a what. So I hope that answers your question, opens up a few more questions. But yeah. yes, at the back there. Well, I haven't been a layperson since 1978. So I can't really talk from direct experience very accurately. But in essence, you're not really looking for all feelings to be nice. One of the most helpful things is to, in a way, to be looking at neutral feeling, because about 98% of the feelings that we do experience are neutral. And it's the pleasant feeling and painful feelings are only about 2% of the whole lot. And mostly, I mean, like the feeling of your shirt on your skin, it's neutral. Or, you know, the feeling of your hands on the chanting book, it's neutral. You know, the feeling of the breath, it's neutral. So just developing that attention on neutral feeling, and just seeing how the world of feeling is experienced, rather than trying to focus particularly on the pleasant or the painful. Also, as I was saying earlier today, just teasing apart that the quality of when there is painful feeling, just teasing it apart, so that the mind gets to know the difference between the feeling of discomfort or unpleasant feeling and the negativity of attitude towards it. It takes a bit of doing, but if you really explore it, you can see there's something is unpleasant, and then there's a kind of a bridge that is crossed where I don't want it, I hate this, when's this going to be over? And when it's just in the realm of feeling, Vedana on its own, it's quite peaceful, quite innocent really. And in the teachings on dependent origination, you have sense contact, feeling, and then craving. And it's often said, it's often pointed out that the weakest link in the chain of dependent origination is between feeling and craving. And so to be able to discern, I don't like is one thing, I don't want is another. And there is a kind of a bridge that's crossed there, and that the world shrinks from, you know, I don't like this, this is unpleasant, to I don't want this, how can I get rid of it, when is this going to be over? And to notice the difference between dislike and hating. Or at the other end of the spectrum, noticing the difference between liking and wanting. Right? You might see something that you like, or you might hear something that you like and say, oh, that's pleasant. And then just noticing how the world shrinks. Like, I want it. And that there's a tension there. There's a stressing in the heart that happens. And just getting to know the difference between I like and I want, or I don't like and I hate. And in a way, developing an awareness of the felt sense of say, liking and wanting, and feeling how they contrast with each other, and similarly disliking and hating. And by, you know, experimenting with that, exploring that, then you can directly know that quality of liking is can be quite spacious. I like it, but I don't have to get it or have it or own it or be looking towards anything at all. It's just pleasant. That's enough. As William Blake puts it, using his sort of 18th century English, he that kisseth a joy as it flies lives in eternity's sunrise. He that binds himself to a joy doth the winged life destroy. He that kisseth a joy as it flies lives in eternity's sunrise. So, since we're in California, kiss the joy as it flies, you know. It's an option, there's a possibility for bumper stickers there. But William Blake really had it, because that's the... if you try to grab it and own it, then you destroy it, you suffocate it. That's the kind... We can use our meditation, our ability to reflect and explore, to look at those very feelings. Yeah, there was a hand down here somewhere. Yeah.
We've been talking, and you've been talking about calming the mind and wisdom, and you mentioned not getting into the area of nihilism. I was wondering how to balance the practice. Do you balance it with loving kindness, compassion? Does that help with not getting into the nihilism?
Yes, yeah, very much. Well, it's the whole area of how we make effort is very useful to look at and to explore. Because on the one hand, if we relate to our practice from self-view, then it's like, I want to become kind, I want to become compassionate, I want to get concentrated, I want to develop insight, I want to get rid of my chattering thoughts, I want to get rid of my afflictive emotions, I want to get rid of my doubts and fears and negativity. And that seems like that's what the books are telling us, or in so many Dhamma talks we hear. So isn't that what we were supposed to be doing? right? But the mistake that we make is that the practice is getting co-opted by self-view, like, I'm this person who's unconcentrated, I've got to become concentrated. I've got these anger problems, or these fear problems, or these lust problems. I've got to get rid of my anger, my fear, and my lust, and then I'll be a beautiful spiritual person. And so even those are wholesome aspirations, because they get co-opted by self-view, what's happening is that the subtle kinds of desire, the desire to become bhava tanha, and the desire to get rid of the annihilating tendency, they're sort of sneaking around the back door and taking over your efforts at meditation. And so even though we can practice with great sincerity, there's this dynamic of, I'm a person with problems, I've got to get rid of, if I get rid of my problems, then I'll be a person without problems, and won't that be fine? but it's still got the person there. And as long as there's the person, it's like the person can't really be freed from the prison because the person is the prison. And that as long as the practice is conceived in I and me, in terms of I and me and mine, then no matter how much effort we put in, how sincere we are, then it's still going to have that frustrating and unsatisfying quality. But then it can be quite confusing because you can hear this and think, but what am I supposed to do? which is a natural enough question. And when we look at the Buddha's teaching, he emphasizes over and over again, this is a path, his teaching is a path of action, it's a path of engagement. Yeah, you know, so many of the lists of, you know, the Buddha was a great list maker, as you probably know. And so many of those lists of spiritual qualities, there's the application of energy, of effort, you know, the seven factors of enlightenment, the Eightfold Path, the right effort, the five spiritual faculties and 10 paramitas, and energy, effort is always in there. So obviously there's an element of acting and engaging that is intrinsic, and the Buddha points that out very directly. So I do not teach a path of passivity, of non-doing. Because some of the spiritual teachers in his own time, that was, they were trying to espouse a path of non-action, of non-engagement, and kind of just basically freezing yourself. He said, that's not what I teach. But if you look at like in the Eightfold Path, the element of right effort, sammavayamo, that really encapsulates the best way to direct our actions. So that the right effort is divided into four aspects. So restraining the unwholesome from arising, as sangvara, or if the unwholesome has arisen, then letting it go. So either having the intention not to give rise to anger, but if anger has arisen, then you let it go. Cultivating the wholesome, like cultivating loving kindness and compassion, concentration, wisdom. And what wholesome qualities have arisen, then maintaining them in being. So with respect to the unwholesome, restraining or letting go. With respect to the wholesome, giving rise to and maintaining. So there's work going on. There's choices being made. There's like, this is unwholesome, okay, let it go. This is wholesome, okay, crank it up, you know, feed it, keep it alive, maintain it. So there's discrimination going on, there's discernment, choices being made. But the difference between that and bhavatana vibhavatana, the desire to become and the desire to get rid of, is there's no self element. There's no sense of self in right effort. What makes it the right element of right effort, the samma, is that it's free from I and me and mine. It's sort of, it's balanced, it's integrated, and so that effort is being made, but it's not being co-opted by the habits of self-view. So yes, the wholesome is being recognized and is being maintained, but that's based on mindfulness and wisdom. That's an action based on mindfulness and wisdom, rather than me. I've got to get more loving kindness in the mix. I should be more compassionate. There's the choices are being made. The effort is being enacted and embodied, but without the ego co-opting the whole process. So that's why the sammavayamo, or right effort, is part of the cure, whereas the desire to become, the desire to get rid of, is part of the illness. And the difficulty is they look really like each other. So the example I always give is like the left and the right hand. They look just like each other, but they're also opposites. And so that essentially the element of self-view and self-centered thinking, the ego-centered habits, the I-making and mind-making. That's the piece that makes a difference. And so with respect to developing the practice, just noticing and being really alert to when that I, me, and mind wades in and is it is sort of intruding. And then, so to recognize that, to know that I making and mind making feeling, to recognize that, oh, this is me practicing, my practice, you know, my mind, you know, I should. And in a way, highlighting that I and me and mine, getting to know that feeling of I-ness and me-ness, my-ness. And to recognize that I feeling is just another mental formation. It's just like the weight of your body on the cushion. Just like the feeling of your glasses on your nose. It's just another feeling. It's just another pattern of consciousness. It's not, there's no thing really there. There's no essential I that is there. It's just a pattern of attitude that arises, passes away. So when we see that I and me and my feelings are empty and don't have to be bought into, then there's a learning of how to apply effort without there be a me got to become this, me got to get rid of that, and that. And often the easiest way of doing it is just as you catch that attitude forming, you just highlight it like, I've got a problem with fear. I need to get rid of it. This is me and my fear problem, and that just by highlighting it, then there's a recognition of, oh, that's not really it. Yeah, there's this feeling of fear arising in this moment, but does it really have an owner? Who's afraid? What's there to be afraid of? What is it that's aware of this? Is there an owner of it? And then exploring and using your reflective ability in that way, then those habits of self-view then tend to fall away on their own. They sneak back in again, but the more that the mind brings the quality of wisdom and mindfulness to bear on it, the more that those self-centered habits of thinking and attitude are recognized, and the more they're seen, and get them front center, they can't stand up in the sort of clear light of day. Yes. Yeah.
I have one question, but I have a follow-up to her question first. In the Buddhist philosophy, is there a recognition of the soul? When I think about non-self and being the watcher, I'm able to disidentify with the I.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's a me who's watching the I. That me is the soul, if you will, and the I is being the ego. And I'm wondering, in the philosophy, is there a concept of, well, maybe I should just ask it more broadly, who is the watcher?
Well, there isn't really a concept of soul in Buddhism. Like in a way, that's one of the defining characteristics of the Buddha's teaching. And it's interesting that he never actually says anywhere in the entire canon, there is no self. People often say that, you know, the Buddha said there is no self. Well, show me. He never says that as a categorical statement. But what he says is that when you look for the self or what or anything that is self, you can't find anything that qualifies that or defines that or constitutes that. So the teaching on anatta is more accurately represented by saying it's a teaching of not self. So it's in a way it's by like a method of exclusion. Like you're rather than trying to define what you essentially are, you learn to stop identifying with what you're not. And so when he uses that teaching the first time, very, very early on, just in the when he was giving the instruction to his five companions that he had reunited with after his enlightenment, there are five friends of his who he practiced with before, he uses that those qualities of anicca, dukkha, anatta, of impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and not self, as a way of helping them to let go of the habits of identification. So he says, you know, is the body changing? Is it permanent or impermanent? It's impermanent. And that which is impermanent and changing, is that something that it can be permanently satisfactory or completely satisfactory? No, it can't be. Okay, that which is impermanent, unsatisfactory, can it be truly said of that, this is me, this is what I am, this is my true self? No. So it's a way of analysis that he's describing, like exploring identification with the body, with feelings, perceptions, mental formations like moods and ideas and thoughts, and then consciousness itself. And so rather than him sort of saying, I declare there is no self, it's like, you're saying, okay, the things that we normally think of as ourself, if they're looked at, they're explored, you can see this isn't really who and what we are. So rather than trying to define what we are in terms of a concept or an idea or a word, his method was to help us to let go of the habits of identification with what we're not, and then what remains is real, is the reality. And so it's got a lot in common with the Christian method, what they call the via negativa, like approaching spiritual reality by defining what God is not, rather than trying to define what God is. And so that's a specific method that he used. In meditation, when you try and find out, you know, try and find who the watcher is, you end up with this you know that you can see that, well, there's awareness, there's knowing, but the more that you try to define that or kind of have any sort of personal find any personal attribute in it, the less you can find, as it were. But it's something to explore, and rather than taking my word for it, to use the meditation to investigate that, because what happens is that the mind is aware of a thought. Oh, this is just a thought, this is just a memory. Like, what's your name?
Rod.
So this is this is just Rod remembering. This is just Rod's thoughts. And this is the awareness of the words. This is Rod's thoughts. That's what this is. Oh, I am the awareness. That's what I am. I am pure awareness. But then at that moment, you're not pure awareness. There's a thought, I am pure awareness, that the mind is attached to. And so that particularly the practice of insight meditation is like, as it were, sort of staying at the back wall of being that awareness, rather than creating an idea. Yeah, I am infinite consciousness. That's what I am. Yeah, I am the knowing quality of the universe. That's what. And then at that moment, that knowing quality has been forgotten, and the attention is latched onto a thought, yeah, an I am. And so what the Buddha's pointing to in his teaching is that all those I ams, they're going to be wide of the mark. And the actuality of what is essentially indefinable. And there's a phrase that he uses over and over again, which in Pali is, yena yena hi manyanti tatatang hoti anyatati. Whatever you conceive it to be, the fact is always other than that. and that's a simple principle. It's like any concept is not it. And so he was criticized in his own time because he wouldn't come up with some kind of metaphysical description about ultimate reality. And so his teachings about ultimate truth are very, very sparse. And 99% of his attention goes on to describing the path to realize that truth for ourselves, rather than trying to describe the truth or describe that ultimate reality. Other than he'll say things like, this is the sublime, or it's peaceful, or this is the good. That's all you get, really. There's not much to hang anything on. But most of his attention is, these are the things that are obstructing the mind from realizing that truth. These are the things that need to be developed to sustain that realization. These are the pitfalls and the hurdles that you're liable to encounter along the way. And so that he was very pragmatic in that approach. So rather than trying to come up with words to describe the indescribable, he just decided, no, I won't bother. Because the words can't do it, but the words can point you the way to help the mind to awaken to its own nature. But coming up with a description or a way of characterizing what that fundamental reality is, words don't do it, so let's not even try. So he just made that like a kind of spiritual choice in the way of how he would approach teaching. And that so that characterizes much of what you find in this particular form of Buddhist teaching.
Had an ongoing argument with a friend about whether consciousness is produced in the brain or whether there's a soul. Mm-hmm. Sense of awareness. And it seems like we'll be on this offer sometime. So I have one follow-up question. I'm new to the practice, and although I've probably at an unconscious level been a mindful and self-reflective person all my life, I only recently started to sit. And I find that when I'm closing my eyes, that's the fastest one-way ticket to India. Is it possible to meditate with your eyes open, or is that inadvisable?
No, you can sit with your eyes open. It's a whatever works is the right thing. Yeah. And because the practice is for you, it's not like that we're just subservient. We don't need to be subservient to the method.
Right.
The method is for you. Yeah. And so it's whatever helps us to wake up and to develop the useful qualities. And it's going to be different for every single one of us. Yeah. So in a way, we each have to craft our own path. And seeing what are the things that really benefit. What are the things that don't work? Because I can put out some instructions, and you can say, well, you know, the first couple of things were really good, but that, you know, that other thing, I don't see that at all. That just my mind is just not working that way. Well, fine. you go with what works rather than how things should be. Whatever, and the focusing on the breath is just a way to help the attention to stay grounded in the present. If that doesn't help, then leave it aside, because it's like if you're already in IRC, you don't need the signpost to get to IRC. Yeah. So if you're here already, then okay, you don't need to get here because you're here already. Okay, I see it's now 8:44, and I've been encouraged to be subservient to the the carefully worked out schedule. Everything in this particular part of the universe is organized on Excel spreadsheets, I am told. So not wishing to offend and go against the system, we can have we'll bring things to a close for this part, and we can have a period of walking for 15 minutes, and then for those who wish, and then a final sitting up until 9:30. So those who wish to sit can sit on, but if you'd like to go and do some walking meditation for 15 minutes, then please do so.